I'm here to share with you personal struggles as a refugee living in East Burnside.
The United States is divided in two categories. It's divided among U.S. citizens and immigrants.
Our humanity should not be defined by our legal status.
It's very difficult for those moms that were living in the camp, thinking that we are going to America for a better life. And now we continue the struggle because the money that we have is not enough. How can we help them? How can we help each other? We need help to organize our community. We need help to be able to help each other, empower each other, and become strong.
I think that this is the first step, and I invite everybody to see it as the first step for changes in this city. You know, it's the first step, and the first step is what we usually don't do.
Oregon is the 11th largest relocation state in the nation, with 1,700 new refugees relocating to Oregon each year. According to the census data from the year 2000, one of eight people located in the Tri-County area is an immigrant, with the majority arriving in the last 10 years. On Saturday, December 3, 2005, PSU's capstone class, The Politics of Immigration, organized an event called Bridgetown Voices, Immigrants and Refugees in Portland. This public forum explored how Portland can better relate to new immigrants and ensure that they have equal access to both process and services. Tonight on Circle A Radio, we will hear from the five panelists. Then we will hear comments from the community that attended the forum. Our first panelist is Evelyn Elohart. She is from the Ivory Coast and presently works at Lutheran Community Services Northwest as the African Women's Coalition Coordinator. She's been in the United States since 2002 and has a background in journalism and social communication.
When you see me in the street of Portland, you will think that I'm African American. Until I say hi to you, then you will say, "You have an accent. Where are you from?" I will say, "I'm from Ivory Coast." And if you're lucky to know where is Ivory Coast, if you don't send me close to Brazil, that's good. We realize that we are not African American, that we are African immigrants living in Portland with our issues. And I would like to just tell you stories. And through the stories, you will understand our struggle. And through those stories, we're going to work together to find solutions. I took the position as the African Women's Coalition coordinator about almost 3 years ago because I saw in that an opportunity to help my sisters. When I came to Portland in January of 2002, it was a rainy, rainy Saturday evening. I was alone. I couldn't speak English, and I was just lonely, isolated. I was feeling cold. One day I took the bus number 6. I was living in the Northeast Portland. When I get off from the bus, I saw a restaurant. And I just read the name Queen of Sheba, Ethiopian restaurant. I just told myself, I don't care it's from Ethiopia. I just want to walk inside that restaurant and see if I can see an African. I did so. And the owner of the restaurant, Alam, offered me tea. And I start crying. He said, "My sister, don't cry. You'll be all right." And since then, I'm just want to share that story with you to tell you that for us, what is very important in the coalition is the welcome of newcomers. We have sisters with their children coming from different refugee camps, arriving in Portland without pretty much nothing, just a plastic bag with all their belongings in that plastic bag. A single mom with a baby, she will receive cash assistance for how much? $360. So I would like to ask city official here, would you please come and teach us how to make a budget with less than $400, be able to pay a rent, pay your bills, baby diaper, because food stamp would not take that. Please come and show us how to do that. It's very difficult for those moms that were living in the camp, thinking that we are going to America for a better life. And now we continue the struggle because the money that we have is not enough. How can we help them? How can we help each other? We need help to organize our community. We need help to be able to help each other, empower each other, and become strong. Because African women are not lazy. We work hard. We care for the children. We care for the household. We take care of our husband. We clean the house. We take up the budget. We cook the food. We go in the farm. We come back. So do not tell me that they arrive here, they don't have skills, transmarketable skills. They don't know what kind of job they can do, and then they have just to stay home. I'm just thinking, should we maybe take one American woman and take her, and maybe in one of our sisters here today from Guinea, put her in a village in Guinea and tell her, you know what? In 8 months, you have to be self-sufficient. You have to learn the language in that village. You have to know how to read and write. You have to be able to walk 5 kilometers to go to your farm. And then at the end of that 8 months, you will see how you're doing. We have been brave, but we need help. And talking about housing, what we did, we just create network. We just made the women become friends. We moved 3 single mothers together in one apartment. And we teach them, we told them, here in America, there's what they call house and roommate. So you have to share. You have to divide to pay the bills. You have to share the food. You have to learn from each other how to write the TriMet system. Those are the small solutions that we came up with. When they talk about housing, affordable housing, I really want somebody to come here and explain to me what affordable means. It's not affordable for us. $600 a month, somewhere here, there in Beaverton and Southwest area. You see where some of those people live. My heart, I just cry. I say, you can't put somebody here. The chicken, the kitchen, the cabinet are not even correct. The house is, the building is dirty, okay? Those women never use a stove. You put them in the stove. You give them laundry detergent. They don't know that this is just for laundry. They will use even some of the detergent and wash the clothes and wash the children, because back home we have one soap, and with one soap we clean everything, right? So those are the basic needs that the case manager is not going to come in the apartment and teach them. Who has to teach them? We are willing to teach each other, but we need the resources. Those women have been in the camp for 14 years, 15 years, sometimes more than that. Okay? The children were born in the camp. The children was running around all day long, like we do home. We run around. The children, they have their own toys. Nobody buys toys in the store for them. They are creative. They are artists. They are brave. They are intelligent. They are very smart. And guess what? They come to the American society now in Portland. What we do, we put them in a school, in a classroom. They have to go to school. It's fine. Okay. Guess what happened in the school? A 16 years old. They put him like in the sixth grade. He never did 1, 2, 3. He doesn't know. He doesn't know how to count. He doesn't know how to read and write. They say, sit there. You have to be quiet. And they're looking at him like my brother David say, like an alien, like he's a monkey somewhere jumping up and down. The teacher thinks that he cannot stay still. So guess what? Next hour, she will call the special ed because she will say, this kid has ADD. There's something going on with him. He needs to see a counselor. There's nothing going on with him. Let now Tom Porter, mayor of Portland, let go back and teach all the teachers of Portland about the African culture. What do we do? What kind of school do we have? What kind of interaction? What kind of game do children play? And then when our teachers receive that kind of trainings, they will be culturally competent to address the needs of our children. If the children are not doing well in school, who is failing? The whole community. So we need to come up with a solution for that. So one of the lack of my community and all the other immigrant community is the lack of resources. And even if there's resources there, like the commissioner said, we don't know they are there. Another thing I love here in America, you don't ask, you don't get. But how can I ask where to go, who to go to, which door to knock? Okay, those are the serious problems that we are facing. They say, oh no, people take care of those refugees. They have money, they have everything. The churches are up there helping them. What church are helping them? What kind of help? After 8 months, they're left alone. No cash assistance. If they're lucky to have a food stamp. And then the Oregon health plan. What kind of health plan? And the struggle continue. But we are strong women. And we will stand up. We will work hard for that. We will succeed. And we need your help. We're there. And we think that you're going to help us. And we would like to join hands together with the other immigrant community and really, really empower ourselves to be able to help our communities, help our children, help our families. So thank you so much for having us in this village, please. Thank you for your help. Thank you for your support. We're ready to work, and we can make this city one of the best where the immigrant can live in America. Thank you.
Our next panelist is Anya Balsamakis. She has been a member of the Slavic Coalition since its founding and has worked with immigrant communities since 1988 with a focus on new arrivals from the former Soviet Union. She is a social worker and community activist.
When I'm talking about myself, I want to make it clear that I'm talking with Vadim and Marina and Olya sitting here with me and other members from my community who couldn't be here today. My name is Anya Balsamakis. I grew up in an immigrant family. My parents arrived here a short time before my birth, and I have spent the last 15 years as a social worker and a community activist, working with the large 50 to 100,000 Russian Slavic community. When I say Slavic, I mean all of the peoples from the former Soviet Union. I rely on the other members of my community because I can depend on them. I can depend on them to get honest feedback, real advice, and true help when it's needed. We're a community that finds it difficult to trust government officials, that prefers to limit trust to a chosen few, a people that are modest about accomplishments, very hardworking, and that cling to family. We are often considered blunt in our directness. We also keenly recognize sincerity and value kindness. Many of you are aware that the last large wave of Russian-speaking refugees and immigrants from the former Soviet Union to Portland started in 1988 and still continues to this day. Today, Portland has countless Russian-owned businesses, a Ukrainian school, many churches, and several of our people are now employed in state and Multnomah County government. Many of you are also aware of the particular challenges of our community. Families that are much larger than the American average, and what that means for housing and education, jobs and health care. Our youth have a dropout rate that is comparable to the Latina community, but it goes unrecognized because many of us are Caucasian and aren't counted as an ethnic minority. We also have language and cultural barriers that keep people from opportunity and keep our generations that are coming poor. We have an elderly population. Many of you don't know that 20% almost of our community are elderly. Our civic life here in Portland is marked by an unfamiliarity with democratic participation and uncertainty about the true meaning of what civic involvement really is and how things really get done here. What many of you don't know is that the amount of activity that goes on behind the scenes among small groups of us that are taxpayers and what we do to improve the community on our own without government involvement. For example, one of the things that we are most proud of is a conference that is in its 10th year this year, and it's a conference for high school students from the former Soviet Union. And each year, we work hard to get over 300 of them together at Mount Hood Community College to give them a chance to know that we value them. We're here as volunteers today because we know it's important for us to hear you and for you to hear us and to be united with other communities of immigrants. We need to take some of the example of Seattle's work in bringing refugee and immigrant communities into the seats of power. We need to meet regularly to share information, concerns, and to air and problem solve issues of importance. There are all the other issues to talk about, but in these few minutes, we've chosen to make these points.
Maria Lisa Johnson is the executive director of the Latino Network, a community-based nonprofit that builds leadership and organizational capacity to affect social change. Ms. Johnson immigrated to the United States 20 years ago from Lima, Peru.
I'm the director of Latino Network. We are an organization that convenes individuals and organizations to advocate for the Latino community, educate and inform public policy, and serve as a force for social change. Let me tell you a little bit about our community. Latinos have been in Oregon since the turn of the century. We're not new to this area, but the population began to settle in the urban areas after the Immigration Reform Act of 1986. Initially, it was a single male population that came and worked in the fields. That population began to settle and then bring their families so that the population shifted from single male to then more families. The settlements began in inner northeast Portland and then started moving to north and Gresham when housing prices began to rise. We're a diverse community, and seeing me here, you probably realize that we come from all over Latin America. Most of our community comes from Mexico, Guatemala, and El Salvador, but then other Central and South American countries. I myself am from Peru. Poverty and immigration status really frame most of the needs and challenges for our community, and particularly our low-income community. These issues spill out into influencing employment, the chances of employment, education, and housing, and so on, very similar to the needs of other immigrant communities. Most of our recent immigrants are in low-paying seasonal jobs that have limited opportunities for moving up the employment ladder. Youth have very limited opportunities as well because most of our youth who are then, you know, coming here have no opportunity to become documented unless we have another Reform Act. We're hoping the city and the Portland Development Commission could look at investing in micro enterprises, as Commissioner Sten said, and small business development, and also investing in the nonprofits that could train our community to expand their skills, to develop their own business opportunities. In the area of education, as Anya said, and I don't want to discount the lack of counting of different communities, Latinos have the highest dropout rate of any ethnic group. 1 in 3 Latinos drop out of school. language barriers and lack of understanding of the educational system keep our families disengaged. The city makes big investments in Portland public schools and could target these investments to strategies that benefit immigrant students, strategies such as dual language immersion. Housing. Our families, particularly in the Rockwood area and St. John's, are doubling up 3 to 5 and more families in single bedroom apartments. We need more options for stable, long-term housing. We also need options for shelter for our vulnerable populations, such as youth who are involved in the system, are getting involved, are getting pulled out of their homes, their families are in dysfunction. We don't know where to send them. There are no culturally specific options for them. And women who are in domestic violence situations. In terms of our community's interactions with the city of Portland, they haven't been so fantastic. Most of the interactions have been framed by the politics of enforcement. Our grassroots community's interactions with the police in particular have been framed by the police's intent to enforce INS policy. And although this has changed, that commitment not to do that has changed. Early on in the 90s, in the Galaxy apartments where some of the first communities began to settle, there were raids. There were raids along Burnside in 97 or so, when the INS was targeting the day labor population. And then, of course, many of you know, one of our community members was shot by the police in 2001, also a day laborer. So a lot of our relationship with the police hasn't been so good. In terms of the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, we've been asked to participate in task force to build on the concept of including communities without boundaries, which are us. We don't have specific targeted neighborhoods where we live. And there's been a lot of process, but we've yet to see the changes. We hope that this will change in the new administration. All of these the city can influence, and we look forward to that being implemented in the coming years. Thank you.
Pam Fawn is our next panelist. She is the United Voices Youth Program Director of the American Friends Service Committee. Her parents came to the United States in 1975 from Vietnam, and she was born in Portland. She has been working for the American Friends Service Committee for 4 years, focusing on social justice, gay and lesbian equality, and racial and economic justice.
To describe to you what the Asian and Pacific American community looks like, it's definitely not monolithic. It's not one culture or one language that we all speak amongst ourselves. We're many different cultures, many different languages from many different countries. We're young people, elders, adults, parents, gays and lesbians, and we come from diverse backgrounds in terms of economic, like opportunities, things like that. So when we say Asian and Pacific American, that means many things, which is true for all of these immigrant groups who are here, that we're all very diverse. So that's the main thing for us all to remember when we're trying to look at problems and trying to create solutions for those problems. To also describe the work that I do, I want you all to know that I don't necessarily speak for the entire Asian community, but I do speak to the work that I do directly with Asian families and with the youth that I'm in contact with through my program. What I do is not necessarily a social service, but it's looking at the root causes of poverty and social injustice and the community needs that we need to address to find solutions to overall economic and social disparities within our communities. And I mainly work on leadership development for young people so that they can gain the tools that they need in order to lead their own communities when they, you know, come of age and at that level of even being youth leaders. So our major concerns span a huge spectrum. Mainly it's access to culturally competent services that we want to seek to break the cycles of poverty and provide real and substantial aid towards self-sufficiency and full participation here in Portland. There have been, in previous years, major cuts within the services that we receive in terms of emergency housing, housing development, and especially in youth diversion, leadership development, and recreation programs, as well as education in general. We're finding that these barriers or these lack of services are increasing our numbers of lack of success. And then we're most interested in improved communication with law enforcement that actually increases the Portland Police Bureau, as well as other law enforcement, with cultural competency dealing with a lot of Asians who are out there on the streets. In the past, we used to have a police liaison at the Asian Family Center, but and that position was lost. Not only reinstating that position, but also increasing or enhancing any services and communication between law enforcement, and also looking at hate crimes in order to decrease what we would consider either anti-Asian or anti-immigrant sentiments that we find increasing across the board. And that also includes profiling by law enforcement itself. In terms of education, we'd like to give both parents and students the tools to participate fully within the system that exists now, but also to reform that system to have our families fit into it with realistic parent outreach. Realistic meaning in terms of parents' working schedules as well as language barriers, all those things that I think are very similar to a lot of the other communities. Housing, healthcare, and all the other basic human needs that are lacking because of a lot of the budget cuts that have happened over the last few years have really put our communities at higher risk for poverty and a lot of the questions that we're all talking about today. Another really important concern for the Asian community is the question of family reunification. A lot of families who have come here as single adults who want to bring the rest of their families, either their children, their spouses, their mothers, and their fathers, that's what's becoming an increasing difficulty, especially with the Patriot Act and a lot of very xenophobic policies that have been instated over the last several years. Part of family reunification isn't just to have more family here, but to make the family stable. Many Asian cultures are very collectivist, and they really need the support of every single family member there in order for it to function properly. Shifting our understanding of immigration policy away from xenophobia, away from the foreign, and towards actually the contributions that we as immigrants give to this country, not only economically, but socially and as well culturally. But mainly just really looking at and identifying, solving for the root economic and educational disparities that our communities are facing, which is the reality for many of our Asian families. Overall, I'd like for us all to think about what the city needs to do, which is to look at a spectrum of issues that are facing all of our communities, not just trying to say, okay, so this particular program or this particular tactic is going to solve the entire problem. Just combat the idea of the rising xenophobia, not only in this country, but also in this city, and just the general anti-immigrant sentiment. So, thanks.
Our last panelist is David Ayala. He is the division director of the SEIU. He was born in El Salvador and came to the United States 15 years ago.
I want to thank to all those who participating and put together this event. I think it's really important to have our voices here in the center of our city, the center of the government in our city, which is the mayor office. When I think about immigration, refugees, and I see all these different faces, and I see my own journey, how I got here, and why I came here. You know, and one thing that I all the time think is about all these clothes that I need to put on my body, you know, to keep myself warm here. It may sound like not as important for some of us. It's a joke. What is the difference it makes how much clothes you wear? But this is an example of, for everybody of who has done this journey to come to this country, is what we have left in our countries to come here, and why we come here, why we move away from our families and move away from our culture and move away for those little things that we love in our countries. And I think that that's one thing that makes us equal and put us together in the same room and in the same place, because we left something in our countries. And we move here, we can talk economical reasons. We can talk looking for a place where democracy, well, at least you are not killed, yeah? looking for refugee for political reasons. We can came here following our husband or our wife who moved here. As I moved to Portland, I follow my wife. And this is part of humanity. And I think that this is the missing piece when we talk about immigration in this country. Because immigrants are human beings. And then when immigrants doesn't fit our political agenda, they are not human beings, and they are converted in aliens who are not human beings. Alien has been making that in the space. And when we call somebody an alien, is somebody who is not human being. Or when we call that person an illegal alien is a criminal, yes? And in our society, criminals are not in with regular U.S. citizens. Where criminals are or where criminals deserve to be, in jail. And then when we call somebody an illegal immigrant, we move it from the regular society. Those two thoughts, I keep those thoughts in my head, and then I move on and I say, immigration, historically, immigration is next to human beings. Historically, human beings move from place to place looking for resources. That's right, my friends, yeah? We move from place to place looking for resources. And that was happening, and that's happening now. And we can relate those movements from what's happening right now. Have you heard about globalization? Have you heard about CAFTA, NAFTA, AFT? Those concepts or economical programs. It's gonna sound, even the names are acronyms, you know. I am Salvadorian, we don't have a lot of acronyms down there. One thing that I learned to this country was to learn acronyms, you know. This is a country of statistics, and it's a country of forms, and it's a country of acronyms, yeah? So AFT, NAFTA, CAFTA, what they are doing, my friends, is making more people who wants to come to this country. It is not an issue of United States. It's an issue of Europe, and it's an issue of Asia. It's an issue for Japan. It's an issue for Germany, France, name it. It's because what these international agreements are doing is making people poor, poorer in our country. You know, in my country, there was the town of shoemakers, Huayua. People from Huayua felt proud because they make the shoes of the country. There was those little factories where, you know, the father had a lot of pride to give those skills to their families, to their kids, to make the best shoes for the country. You know what is now? Huayua? There is no shoemakers in that town. You know why? Because transnationals have taken all those jobs away. And now what they want to do is everybody needs to be an employee. Everybody needs to have a job. If we don't have a job, we are not independent anymore. You know, in El Salvador, our ancestors have the god of corn. We were born from corn. And you know what CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, is doing? El Salvador is going to import corn from the United States. You know what that means? We are not going to be able to produce corn anymore. And it's not because we are not able to produce corn. It's because it's this international trade agreement. And you know what's going to happen? A lot of people are going to continue trying to come to this country. So those are the three ideas I want to leave in your heads. It's kind of one is that migration is attached to humanity. The second idea that I want to leave in your heads is that don't make the same mistakes that some people in power want to have for us. Immigrants are not aliens. Immigrants are human beings, as we are. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
are listening to Circle A Radio. This is a recording of Bridgetown Voices, a neighborhood forum which took place inside City Hall December 3rd, 2005, about immigrants and refugees in Portland. We will now hear community voices who offered comments and testimony.
Short words about the African Community Coalition of Oregon. We're trying to make sure that we get a group that will speak for all of us so that when we have problems, we can easily focus them so that the city and the county will be able to help us solve those problems. And I've just written some statement that I want to make. I am saying that most of the Africans currently in the Portland area have come abroad largely as a direct result of intractable wars and political instability, and to a smaller scale, economic pursuits. There are currently a myriad of pertinent problems such as housing, language barriers, health issues, immigration, education, and workforce. I'd like to take one or two aspects of education and immigration problems affecting our communities today. The refugee and immigrant families live in various refugee camps for long periods of time before immigrating to the United States. There are usually no schools or academic training facilities at these camps. The refugee families therefore arrive in the U.S. with children at the ages of 5, 7, 10, and 20, with little or no ability to read the English alphabet. The policy as we know it in Portland does not consider the academic standards of the refugee child. The school districts almost always admit these children without any formal education to class grades that are more akin to the child's age than his or her knowledge base. This is surely a disaster, and on the face of it, appears to be a policy designed for the child to fail. We advocate that refugee children in similar situations should be allowed to attend classes with children of similar knowledge base. Alternatively, institutions like the African Community Coalition should be encouraged and helped to provide in-house classes or like Saturday classes for the children of such poor backgrounds. After all, the Community Coalition of Oregon is African and is able to marshal the educated Africans in the community to help out. Another area of concern is the speed with which some organizations purporting to help the African refugees are driving new arrivals to the workforce. African women and children and the aged have been referred to janitorial, factory-type jobs, cold storehouses, and warehouses type of jobs without adequate preparation and training. These are frustrating experiences for the new arrivals. We acknowledge the need to help and actively support the economy, but we feel that an educated worker is far more productive than one that is not so endowed. So the new ACO that is operated by Africans and serves the needs of the African refugee and immigrant communities hopes, with the help and the support of places like the city and the county, to steer new arrivals to existing social services and in the long term provide some of these services in-house by themselves.
My name is Rolia, and I'm a school teacher with Portland Public School. I'm a second grade teacher, and I'm an advocate for the African kids within the school. And I think that the newly arrived refugee children are coming here are having a lot of problems. These kids need a transitional place before they get into the school system. They are failing, and they end up going to jail, and we don't want our kids to become statistics. Thank you.
I'm honored to be here today in all of your presence. I work at Marshall Campus, which used to be Marshall High School, in one of the neighborhoods that has the highest populations of immigrants in Portland. We are considered a problem area, a problem school, but our pride far outstrips that reputation. We have roughly 30 languages spoken on our campus, and we are deeply proud of that. Three suggestions for everyone who is here to use your voice to help us do the best that we can. I would say one is push for more people of color to become teachers and other educators in our schools. We have over 100 people who work in some capacity or other at this campus, and I could give you on my one hand the people of color at our campus. If we include a few more people from the Slavic community, it is still less than 10. That is not correct. Secondly, we need true and valuable cultural competency training for every single person in the school system. And thirdly, we need volunteers from every single ethnicity that our students are to come into the school and be role models and be mentors. Basically, it is not relevant for me to stand in front of a student who I do not share experience with and say, follow my path. But it is extremely relevant for successful people from their own ethnic group to say, follow my path. And that's what I wanted to say.
My name is Françoise Tambou. I'm from Democratic Republic of Congo. I came to Portland about 2 years ago as a refugee resettled by Catholic Charities. I'm a widow with 8 children. I'm here to share with you personal struggles as a refugee living in East Burnside. In July 2004, I lost my son, Yves Ndeme, by a hit and run at the corner of Southeast Foster Road and 8th Avenue. He was my last born and a student at Binsmith Middle School. He was an intelligent boy. Ronald Kale Johnson, who was arrested 3 months later, killed him. Mr. Johnson will spend 3 years in jail, and then he will work and pay me $5,000 to reimburse the funeral cost. Is it how much a 13-year-old boy is worth in America? I find this ridiculous. Mr. Johnson did not have a liability insurance, therefore, there is nothing the Justice Department can do for me. I was disappointed and devastated to see that the country of freedom and justice couldn't give me justice for the loss of my loved son. We survived many conflicts and ran away from rebels in Congo and live in Zambia and Rwanda for many years. My son didn't die there in those poor living conditions. I came to America, land of opportunities, to give my son a better life. Instead, a drunk driver, Mr. Ronald Kale Johnson, killed him. America welcomed us as refugees, and we were told that we will have a better life and that we will find peace, justice, and security. In many cases, I didn't see that when I lost my son. I started asking myself many questions about the reasons my claim was denied. Is it because English is my second language and I couldn't get any interpreter to communicate my needs to the Justice Department? Is it because I'm a widow, single mom, with 8 children and that the loss of one does not matter? Is it because I'm not American citizen and don't know my rights? Is it because I'm a foreigner that does not know American laws? Is it because I did not go to the right office or knock on the right door? Should I have to learn quickly English and enroll into a law school? just to defend myself and receive justice for my son, Eve. Could you please help me find answers to my questions? I don't want to be too long in telling my story. I hope that I was able to give you a clear vision of my struggle and my pains.
Let us have a 1 minute silence for Mr. Johnson, her son. Thank you. Let's have a 1 minute silence. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Benjamin Alote. I'm from Ghana. I've been here for about 35 years now. And I'm a member of the African Community Coalition of Oregon. And I have a suggestion that I want to make. If you can make available to us business cards of those officials from the mayor's office, the commissioner's office, that we can talk to, because our businesses cannot get started from this meeting here now. It's all going to get started later. We cannot meet here again like we're doing now to find out who to talk to. So it'd be nice if we can have business cards on the table somewhere so that some of our leaders will pick up those cards. And then later on, when we put ourselves together with our problems and things, we want to know who to talk to. We know who to call.
My name is Mabrahatom Abraham, and I've been in this country since 1981. I went to high school here. When I came to this country, I've been told that America is a land of opportunity, equality, fraternity, and so many things. When I came over here, what I thought was gone long time ago, I faced it, and it was still happening. And I became a part of it. In 1988, I have a good friend, more like a brother to me. He was killed by a skinhead. My anger is beyond control. But I turn around, I look at him, and I find out that they are still doing it to us. So, right now, we have paid our share of pain. We have paid our share of sweat. Now, we are ready to take a part of the pie that you have been sharing. Right now, for having an opportunity to sit down over here and talk about this, thank you for doing this opportunity, because if we sit together, maybe we'll come up with a solution. Again, I'm from Eritrea. I hope most of you know where Eritrea is, because we lost about 500,000 people to create that country in 1993. And at the same time, I am a member of the African Community Coalition of Oregon. Thank you.
My name is Rivka Sadarangani. I'm with Portland Community Media. To all the community organizations represented here today, please contact us at Portland Community Media to get your voice out there, to get information, whether it's for your services, cultural events, or any other issue forums like this. And as an immigrant myself, I just hope that everybody here would leave today with the sense that our humanity should not be defined by our legal status. So whether legal or illegal alien or whatever you would choose to call us today or tomorrow, that our humanity should not be denied, and the services and basic human needs we have should be maintained.
And again, this is David Ayala from the SEIU Local 49.
I was an undocumented immigrant 15 years ago. I crossed the border illegally. I was arrested and I was thrown back, and I came back. I have that experience myself. And I have been working for 13 years helping undocumented immigrants to educate them and to acquire legal documents now. I see that fixing our immigration laws, now I am a U.S. citizen. But I have a history. I am not black, I'm not white. God or the nature gave me this weirdo color in my face. It's not even coffee, you know? But there is one real thing here. For me, there is several issues, yeah? And we are talking about housing, we are talking about schools, we are talking about this. But there is one real issue, my friends. The United States is divided in two categories right now, especially after September 11, 2001. You know? It's divided among U.S. citizens and immigrants. It's divided among U.S. citizens and immigrants. And in immigrants, you put all of those legal permanent residents, green card holders, or whatever you call them, now it's pink, or whatever call is now, refugees, asylees, TPS, etc., you name it. There is two categories. And if you see the news, those who are arrested and those who are detained for terrorist acts are immigrants usually. And those who are detained indefinitely are immigrants, are not U.S. citizens. There is only one U.S. citizen who is detained indefinitely. And those who have been arrested and hasn't been charged has been immigrants and has been arrested and charged with using the immigration law, not the terrorist laws. What I'm going with this is that we, my friends, we need to become U.S. citizens in some way if we are going to stay here. And we need to change the immigration laws. And I know that the city hall, it doesn't have the answer for that question. This is a federal law. Yeah? And that's one thing. The second thing for me is look at the floor. When we have had this gathering before, my friends, I have never, 15 years I have been living in this country, I have never seen so many Africans in a room with all those beautiful colors that you wear. And I haven't seen, you know, other ethnicities talking among and sharing their experiences. I think that this is the first step, and I invite everybody to see it as the first step for changes in this city. You know, it's the first step, and the first step is what we usually don't do. The issue that I wanted to point out is the issue about that this is the start of something big, and we need to hear each other about what we have.
Bridgetown Voices, Immigrants and Refugees in Portland was a public forum that was partially sponsored by the Community Language and Culture Bank. To find out more about them, go to www.clcbank.org.
In recent news, six activists across the country have been arrested on charges of eco-terrorism in Oregon and Washington, with alleged crimes dating back to 1998. These arrests happened on December 7th in New York, Virginia, Oregon, and Arizona in a coordinated raid by the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security. Two of the defendants face life in prison. It has been difficult to find out information about these cases, but we believe that all six defendants are being held without bail. Another six activists, including Frank Winbigler and Shannon or Nani Urich of Portland, have been served subpoenas for related federal grand jury hearings. Frank and Nani were informed that they are also targets of these investigations. Donations for Frank and Nani's legal support are being accepted at Tarantula Distribution, 818 Southwest 3rd Avenue, PMB 1237, Portland, Oregon, 97204. Donations should be well-concealed cash or checks or money orders with the pay to left blank or paid to as cash. Also include a note specifying that these funds are in support of Frank and Nani. Donations can also be made using PayPal at socialwar.net/no-grand-jury/. More information is available there as well. For more information on all of these cases, we suggest the Portland and New York City Indie Media websites. You've been listening to Circle A Radio. We're on KBOO 90.7 in Portland every first and third Wednesday of the month at 6 p.m. Stay tuned as we continue to cover this and other stories that you're not hearing a lot about in other media. Circle A Radio finally has a new website, www.circlearadio.org. So check it out. It now has online listening capabilities thanks to Radio for All. We're slowly uploading shows and we would love to hear your feedback. Drop us a line at info@circlearadio.org. As always, thanks for listening.